that they would enforce the beliefs and practices of the Church of England. And we'll look at some of the early history as Christian records it, and then we'll look at some of the other material that I've accumulated over the years, just a portion of it that'll help us to have a little better understanding of this particular country. The Episcopalians retained full possession of the country about a century. Now, the Episcopalians, Church of England, are exactly the same thing. The reason they use the word Episcopalian is because after the Revolutionary War, the term Church of England was so filled with bad connotations that they changed their name and called themselves Episcopalians, patterned on the form of their government. So you'll see that term after the Revolutionary War. Prior to the Revolutionary War, it's generally the Anglican Church, or sometimes the Church of England, but most of the time Anglican Church. You remember there was a term that applied to the people in Virginia who, and other colonies too, but particularly in Virginia, who were loyal to the crown during the Revolutionary War. Do you remember the word that was used?
Tories.
Tories, absolutely. And the Tories, after the Revolutionary War, were sort of like the Democrats in Congress right now. They were severely chastised and confused, and they didn't know exactly what to do. And that's that circumstance existed then. Other opinions began to creep in, and the care of the government to support their own church, having begotten an equal degree of indolence in its clergy, two-thirds of the people had become dissenters at the commencement of the Revolution. The laws, indeed, were still oppressive on them, but the spirit of the one party had subsided into moderation. And that's really, I don't think, exactly a true statement. He tells us that among the earliest buildings reared at Jamestown was one consecrated to the service of the church. The most zealous care of the colonial assembly for more than a century after the settlement was to cement the union between the government and the church. He tells us that it enforced Sabbath worship in accordance with its ritual and creed under heavy penalties for its neglect. At the bottom of page 184, he states, the charter of the colony made the Church of England an established part of the law of the land. The first charter granted by James I, April 10, 1606, was for a time the organic law. That part of the charter which relates to the religion is as follows. We do especially ordain and require the said presidents and councils and the ministers of the said several colonies respectively, within their limits and precincts, that they, with all diligence and care, respect, do provide that the true word and service of God and Christian faith be preached, planted, and used, not only within every one of the said several colonies and plantations, but also as much as they may among savage people, I suppose that would be the Indians, don't you, which do or shall adjoin unto them, according to the doctrine, rites, and religion now professed, and established within our realm of England. In this statement, they talk about anyone who would withdraw. And if they shall find within the said colonies and plantations any person or persons so seeking to withdraw, any of the subjects of us, our heirs, our successors, or any of the people off these lands and territories, within the precinct aforesaid, they shall with all diligence him or them so offending cause be apprehended, arrested, and imprisoned until he shall fully and thoroughly reform himself, or otherwise when the cause so requireth, that he shall with all convenient speed be sent into the realm of England. Now, at the bottom of page 185, there is a part of the code of Sir Thomas Dale. This didn't last long as a guide to dealing with the people who would not support the Church of England, but it does give us some insight into the particular savagery with which these people treated those who might disagree with them. Now, at this time, as far as we know, there are not any Baptists in this area. They're just writing these things with the idea of dealing with people who will not give themselves fully to religion in a very severe way. And here's the problem that they were having. In England, there was really not anywhere to go. It was a well-settled country. They had a good system of sheriffs in each county. They had jails. People were willing to inform. But when you got to America, especially in 1610, 15, or 20, there wasn't anything between them and Canada, and them in and all the way to Augustine, Florida, then west, clear to the Pacific Ocean. So you couldn't hem a guy in as far as arresting him, although it's kind of a bad circumstance to get caught out in the wilderness, but they're just such a vast territory that people just didn't even, they could get away so easily. Now, all of this is east of the Appalachian Mountains. You remember the Appalachian Mountains runs all the way from, what about Georgia, doesn't it? Clear up the east coast to, well, the Adirondacks actually are part of that chain, I think. But they never really thought about anything west of the of that particular mountain chain for a long time. There was the Blue Ridge Mountains, that was part of it, and everything over that mountain was just unknown territory. It's like sailing off the end of the world. The people could get lost, and so it was difficult to enforce this. Now, there's not one man nor woman in this calling, now present or hereafter arrived, but shall give an account of his or their faith and religion, and repair unto the minister, that by his conference with them he may understand and gather whether they have been sufficiently instructed and catechized in the principles and grounds of religion, whose weakness and ignorance the minister finding, and advising them in love and charity to repair often to him, to receive therein a greater measure of knowledge. If they shall refuse to repair unto him, and he the minister give notice thereof to the governor, or the chief officers of that town, or fort wherein he or she, the party so offending, shall remain, the governor shall cause the offender for the first time of refusal to be whipped. That's a real tool for building a Sunday school, I'd say, wouldn't you? I send for you and you don't come, one whipping. For the second time, to be whipped twice. I guess that would be twice as good, don't you? And to acknowledge his fault on the Sabbath day in the congregation, and third time to be whipped every day.
For how long?
Until he hath made the same acknowledgement. And asked forgiveness. That's what, whip you every day till you went before the congregation and said, I want you to forgive me.
Or die.
Or die. That'd be 6 days from then, wouldn't it? I'd want them to organize real quick.
In a lot of this book, there's a lot of punishment needed out of issues for certain things, and years crossed, and fingers and toes and all this stuff. Would this actually carry to the teeth, or is it like a lot of our laws today, and it's most of the time ignored, and if someone really ruffles someone's feathers?
This particular document here, the Code of Sir Thomas Dale, was so offensive even to the people that were Episcopalians, or rather Church of England people. So this is applying to them, not just heretics. This is for everybody, and it was just too much. And they really didn't carry out a great deal of this. But it was on the books, and it gave people the idea of, well, it frightened people, to be quite honest with you. It was difficult to enforce this because simply the lack of court system. These people, and another thing, if you just got a few people, if there's 150 people, and that's all there is. It's kind of hard to form a good community spirit when you start whipping people. They have a tendency to break up in pockets, and there's a lot of resistance to it, so they just neglected a lot of it. And then the reportings of whippings in Virginia, which is a little bit later, in 1778 even, there were whippings in Virginia, but they were never done by order of a court from the court system. We know that it happened. What did happen, the sheriffs and things took it on their own to do it when they arrested Baptist preachers. So there was not, these things were not completely enforced, but they were on the books.
Seems like this Captain Argall didn't think it was turned up, though.
Well, they want to turn it up a little bit. Have you ever noticed that when people carry religion from the heart to the flesh, that they always want to get more and more severe in the punishment? Have you ever noticed that? Sometimes Baptist churches get caught up in this attitude, not to this extent. They begin to make rules and regulations, like if you miss 3 Sundays, then you've got to come before the church, and if you don't have a good excuse, they're going to automatically exclude you. Laws that you cannot find in the Word of God ought to be totally rejected by God's people.
Right.
We ought not to make laws. Okay? We ought not to make laws. When we do, we always get in trouble. We never made a law that we didn't get in trouble. And you say, well, you got to do something to get people to come to church. Listen, what did we learn the first semester? A forced religion is what? No religion at all. Okay? And that's true whether it's Baptist pressure or whether it's Catholic pressure or whether it's Episcopal pressure. Anything other than persuasion is never counted of God. Okay? And that has to be a persuasion with the limits of the Word of God and the work of the Holy Spirit. Anything goes beyond that, you have a fake, what we would call a false religion. Anyway, it was pretty serious to miss church. He says, these were times when the religion was to be taught with a whip, when the heart was to be affected with the punishment of the body, and when prayer was the only means of escaping the gibbet. So, it just too much. It didn't really gather that much practice. But let's look here on page 187, where it talks about the first act of Parliament, 1623, is provided that in every plantation or settlement, there shall be a house or room set apart for the worship of God, which literally means these, you had to provide a place for a religious service. A person absent himself from divine service on Sunday without a reasonable excuse forfeited a pound of tobacco. And he that absent himself a month forfeited 50 pounds. Any minister who was absent from his church above 2 months in a year forfeited half his salary. Miss a year. Or rather 2 months, miss half his salary. And he who absent himself 4 months forfeited the whole. Here, what they're talking about is, here's a guy who comes and holds services maybe once a week at the very most, maybe once a month or whatever, and he loses his salary if he doesn't show up. Whoever disparaged a minister whereby the minds of his parishioners might be alienated was compelled to pay 500 pounds of tobacco and ask the minister's pardon publicly in the congregation. The first allowance made to the ministers was 10 pounds of tobacco, a bushel of corn for each tithable, and every laboring person of what quality or condition was bound to contribute. Year 1631, the assembly granted the ministers, besides the former allowance, 10 pounds of tobacco, a bushel of corn, the 12th calf, the 20th kid, and the 20th pig. If you want to put this in perspective, suppose that you were allowed 500 pounds of marijuana as your payment for a year's preaching right now. Pretty good salary, right? You wonder, well, hey, what's 2 pounds of tobacco. What's 20 pounds of tobacco? Doesn't mean anything. It's just for, you could buy, what, you know, $100 maybe at the most. No, absolutely not. Tobacco was more valuable at this particular time than marijuana is at this particular time to people who live in our society. You know, they've come over here and found out that the Indians didn't have consumption. They got trying to figure out why they didn't have consumption, and they saw them rolling this leaf up and smoking it. So they the doctors, the scientific minds, grabbed that real quick and said, we know what happened. That warm smoke being blown down into your lungs killed that germ. You know, smoke would kill stuff. They figured, hey, you got germs down in there, or old bad, whatever it is. Pull it down in there, hold it for a while, and that's going to kill those bad germs that's making you cough. So they started shipping it back to Europe. You couldn't buy it except by prescription for a long time. In Paris, the only people who could afford it in Europe were the wealthy, the kings and the aristocracy. It was just like a medication that was beyond the reach of people. So tobacco is extremely valuable. But here in America, you grew it so you could give it to a guy, but it was valuable in Europe. It wasn't so valuable here because, of course, people got, after they forced themselves to do it over a long period of time, well, they got hooked on it and began to experiment with other ways to use it, such as to cut it up. The reason they cut it up and rolled it in paper was just get more nicotine, okay? And then, of course, they ground it up and made snuff out of it. See, if it cured lung disease, it also cured sinus, okay? So you just grind it up as it was a medicine. And to get it up in your sinus cavity, well, you had to pull it up in there. First offering ever taken for more foreign missions, as we know it, was taken in an empty snuff box that the pastors had emptied during Saturday's meeting. Baptist preachers. They were looking around going to take an offering for missions. Literally, the first mission offering ever was, they found an empty snuff box, and they passed it among the pastors and took the offering. That's a... You know, we probably wouldn't take the offering today if it would... I tell you, tobacco has had a part in Baptist life over a rather long period of time, and maybe more than we would ever admit. And by that I mean, here in certain areas it's condemned roundly, but in Virginia and other places, Kentucky, hey, it was your salary, okay?
Some of that's still the prevalence.
Yeah. You know how they shut the pastors from preaching against tobacco in Kentucky, how they shut them up? They gave them, and they said, now this is your salary, preacher. It was half acre of tobacco, whatever. And that's what your salary is this year. It's a pretty good salary, but here's a guy who's going to get a book of condemned tobacco when it's going to be reaping. It's kind of like Christmas right now. I'm not preaching against it, are you? I would the 4th of July or something, but not any later than that, because you're going to mess up your own Christmas gift. You know, we don't want to offend the preacher and give him something with Christmas, you know. I mean, I got better sense than that. Even my enemies admit that I have 1 eye and a half cents, which is partially true anyway. The worst thing that I've read in here was their punishment for blaspheming. Did you notice that? Thrusting a bodkin through the blasphemer's tongue. Anybody know what a bodkin is?
A long spoon of wood that was used to wash hands.
Yep. And fires. Carry fire from one place to another. That would do it, wouldn't it? I don't know that they did these that much, but anyway, it was what you were going to get anyway.
Next time they spoke it, nobody would understand it.
Well, I imagine, you know, you introduce some infection and things of that nature, so it's going to cause some real problems. Now, as to the clergy in Virginia, he has some real revelations to make about these people. First of all, he says that they got the worst of the crop, because every Anglican clergyman who could would stay in England, become pastors of the real famous stone and stained glass churches. And obviously, that's where the real fame and power was. It was in England. The guy just couldn't make it. Very few of these people had a sense of going to another country and starting over again. After they're in total power in England, why come over here to this quote God-forsaken area and suffer all that they did with just a few and a congregation of people and really no buildings of any stature or any congregations of any size? Why bother with that? So it's sort of the scum that got brought off over here, and it describes the kind of character they had. They could babble in a pulpit, roar in a tavern, exact from their parishioners rather by their dissoluteness destroy than feed the flock. So here's these people who were their pastors and who really didn't care for them. They were here because they couldn't get anything else. Now, what's happening, and this is going to culminate in a very important thing for Baptists. In Virginia, the first people who became Baptists were poor people. And the movement in Virginia was not very fast in the beginning at all, as we'll see. And they did not affect very many of these landed aristocracy folk, the educated, until after the Revolutionary War. After the Revolutionary War, then the well-educated people who had been Anglican didn't want to have anything to do with Church of England because it had opposed the Revolution. Now they're looking for a place to go to church. They're willing to change. And they have been very much impressed since about 1760 by the suffering of Baptist people. They've been very much impressed by the Baptists who've been involved in the Revolution. They're very much impressed with the Baptists who have articulated the separation of church and state. So when they looked for a church, they had a really favorable impression of Baptist people, because their lives were very, very good. They were clean and from the viewpoint of a moral character. And so after the Revolutionary War, the Baptists in Virginia especially, they just exploded as far as growth is concerned. And but here you're laying the framework for people's disillusionment with the established clergy. Any time that a clergyman draws his salary, whether his congregation likes him or not, he's going to have to be an extraordinary person to really listen to his people and try to help them and pastor them, okay? Now, if you're just getting your check by mail and there's not anything they can do to touch you, you know, just natural flesh would have a tendency to sort of slough off and let it go. That's kind of the way humans are. And that happened here in Virginia too. Now, he tells us that Baptists originated from three general sources. The first came from England about 1714. Some of these Baptists wrote letters to England asking for assistance. And that was a very common thing. Baptists had helped one another in England. You remember in 1707 is when we had the first association formed around London with seven churches. And one of the first things they aimed at was sort of helping the poor churches support their pastors. Well, all of a sudden, here guys over in America, all the way across the Atlantic, and they're not wealthy people, And they're asking people to help them. So we do know that they came into this area, but many of them were General Baptist, and we would not, they were the General Baptist that washed feet and believed and fallen from grace, have an Arminian type theology. So that was a little, they were here first, I guess, in Virginia, as to the others were. But they tell us by 1756 they had begun to embrace some Calvinistic sentiment. The church at Burley wrote the Philadelphia Association the following letter. The Church of Jesus Christ in Isle of Wight County. Have any of you been in the East Coast? You know the Isle of Wight? Anybody travel in that area?
I've been in the East Coast. I don't know where that is.
It's an isle off the coast, is it not? A small one? It is an island, is it not? The Isle of Wight. I'm really asking for information. I'm pretty sure that, aren't there several little islands off the coast of the Carolinas and
well, Cape Ladders?
There is off the Georgia, I do know
okay.
that, because that's where one of the Methodist founders.
Yeah. You won't really think too much about it, but there are some little islands off the coast. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So these were the first things they settled when they came to here, and of course the reason was safety. You know, it was safer on the island where you could defend yourself than it was in the mainland. Of course, Jamestown, they couldn't have picked a sorrier place hardly to live in Jamestown, infested with mosquitoes, low. They wouldn't move on up the river into the higher regions. But I tell you, you really can't do much serious criticizing of these people when you think of just the immensity of the thing that they see over here. It would be overwhelming to leave a country and then just all of a sudden, you know, months later to just land here and try to pick out a place to live. That was quite a feat that they did. No, hopefully. Well, they had all the land to clear. They had everything to do. And so we're coming up on this first... Up on this first Thanksgiving, you know, which was, I think, pretty good day. The next, excuse me, go ahead. No, the turkey never came back. But I did buy her gun, and I loaded it, and it's there by the kitchen door, with instructions, not on how to shoot the gun, but to her, okay, to kill the turkey. Well. Game laws being what they are, we have a different way of getting rid of that stuff. Not the garbage can. Don't do that. The next appearance of the Baptists was in the counties of Berkeley and Loudoun. Several churches were organized, which a Creek seems to have been the most prominent. A number of the members of the General Baptist Church at Chester Ridge, Maryland, 1743, moved to Virginia. So what do we got? We got some people who came from England over here. We got some people who moved down from the northern colonies here. And so that's a source of Baptists in Virginia. But notice the date, 1743. How many more years till 1776? Not many, is it? Boy, I tell you, they've done a good job keeping the people out of Virginia. They've done a good job of it, because they're just beginning to show up, you know, 30 years before the Revolutionary War and Declaration of Independence. So that's really not a long time. He states that many churches in this section of the country were loosely constituted and serious trouble existed among them. On request, the Philadelphia Association sent a committee composed of James Miller and David Thomas to settle their difficulties. This course was often pursued by that association. The committee was accompanied by John Gano. Remember John Gano? He was in this area. He went back. He pastored the First Baptist Church in New York City. He was also personal chaplain to General George Washington. It's said that he did baptize him. His grandkids and great-grandkids say that that's what they heard him say. Let's look at page 195, an account that John Gano gives. I think you can relate to this. We examined them and found they were not a regular church. We then examined those who offered themselves for the purpose, and those who gave us satisfaction we received and constituted a church. Out of the whole who offered themselves, there were only three received. Some openly declared they knew they could not give an account of experience and work of grace. Now, you're familiar with that term, are you not? Give us your experience of grace. You know what that means. Don't you? Tell us about when you were saved. And according to the historians that I have read, these churches in Virginia really didn't have a very good comprehension of the way of salvation. And when things like this occurred, they really didn't have much of a testimony. And when the separates, the New Light separates, you remember we talked about them last week? You remember how they preached? Carried on? When the New Light separates came down, they were converts of the Whitfield revivals, and they preached an experimental religion. And in fact, it got to be a problem a little bit later on with this for the regular Baptist in Virginia and the separate Baptist, because the emotionalism of separate Baptist, they didn't quite get along. It took them quite a long time sort of come to a meeting where they could get along. But anyway, therefore need not offer themselves. Others stood ready to offer if the church was formed. The three before mentioned were constituted, and six more were baptized and joined with them. After the meeting ended, the number of old members went aside and sent for me. They expressed their deplorable state and asked me if I would meet with them that evening and try to instruct them. They were afraid the ministers blamed them. They had been misled, but it was not their fault, and they hoped I would pity them. I told them I would with all my heart and endeavored to remove their suspicions of the ministers. They met, and I spoke to them from these words. They, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves to the righteousness of God. These people in Virginia were in isolated areas. They were just more or less existing without schools and churches. And the northeastern segment of the nation had already developed a pretty good system of education and schools and things, and they drifted down in here bringing some competent preachers with them and did a good work. Well, let's look at, they give us this account here of the Baptists in Virginia, North Carolina, and Georgia. Not spend much time with that. I want to give you some of the things that I've accumulated in regard to Baptists in Virginia. You'll come across, as you read in here, the name Dutton Lane, but they don't give an account of his conversion and of his mother's conversion and of his ultimately his father's conversion. But here's a very touching story, as I would define it. James Lane, who had owned a farm near the town of Richmond, Virginia, from the early years of the 18th century, had a son, Dutton, who disobeyed his explicit orders not to go hear that fiery evangelist, George Whitfield, preach. Not only did Dutton Lane go to hear Whitfield, but after the spell of the great preacher's magnetic voice, personality, and ardor, the youth made a profession of faith. While Dutton Lane knew that Whitfield was an English separatist and not a Baptist, he liked what Whitfield preached about religious freedom. So Lane joined a small Baptist church there in the heart of Virginia, was ordained to preach, and began his own remarkable career as an evangelist. This disobedience and drift into heresy so enraged James Lane that he disowned his son and warned his wife never to go hear Dutton preach. However, she was a strong-willed woman. At that time, when the promise to obey in the marriage ceremony was taken literally by wives and strictly enforced by husbands, Mary Lane did what she thought was right, with or without her husband's consent. So, on a Sunday morning, when Dutton came to hold what was known as a protracted meeting in the Baptist church nearest the Lane plantation, Mary slipped out of the house, put the side saddle on her mare, and went to hear him. Mary Lane readily admitted to her husband that she had gone to the Baptist meeting house to hear their son preach. Seizing his horsewhip, James Lane stood his wife against the wall and beat her unmercifully. Then he took his musket, loaded it with powder and ball, and vowed to heaven he would find his heretic son and kill him, and rode away. For some reason, probably the sight of Lane's musket and his obvious anger, no one around the vicinity of the Baptist meeting house seemed to know where the young preacher had gone. The father returned home, somewhat cooled off by his ride. There the spirited Mary, still nursing the wounds from her husband's whip, quietly challenged his sporting blood. "You give a bird a chance to wing before you shoot it," she said. "Why not give Dutton a chance? Go hear him just once." Now, do you know what she was saying? You ever hunt quail? You ever shoot him on the ground while he's in the covey? Why? That's not sporting, is it? Wait until the covey flushes and then you shoot your bird. And it's nothing but a low-down, dirty suck egg would shoot him on the ground. Unless it snows now and they all congregate up and face out, you know, and then you could kill 12 at one shot. You would never do that in Sharp County, though. Not around Cave City. Nor shoot the fox that they all run all the time. Bad move. They had a red fox that lived right around town, and they let their dogs loose on Saturday in the summer and raised the windows and lay in their beds listening to dogs run the fox. And he'd circle up north, come back around and cross, you know, and everybody, and their dogs just come home. It's an easy way to fox hunt, you know. And we had a fellow there who was who fixed television sets, so he ordered him an electronic collar, which was a rabbit squealing. Set it up just outside his house on a little hill, cedar glade, and turned it on and sat there. It was 22, and a few minutes here came a big red fox. He killed it, took it down to the buffet to show these guys that had been hunting it for 3 or 4 years. "You guys ain't no hunters. Look at me. I killed it the first time I tried." And he lost a lot of television sales over that. And they were really, really hot about it. So Mary appealed to James Lane's sporting blood. You know, you don't shoot a bird till you give him a chance. Go hear Dutton preach one time. After some hesitation, James Lane agreed he would go hear his son just this once. When the service was over, Lane shook his son's hand and walked out without a word. But he came back time and again, sat under a spell while his son called people to repentance and salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. In relating what happened many times in his career as a pastor and evangelist, Elder Dutton Lane would say, "At last he decided I was preaching the truth. He came forward under conviction of sin. I baptized him, and he became a pillar of that church." That's good stuff, you know. I guess of all the things, and this is just an observation, okay? You think about it with me, okay? Of all the things we miss in our congregation, it's things of this nature. How long has it been since a man, 40 years old, who lived outside the church and was angry at the church, who you had to just almost go around, and everybody knew he despised the church and despised preachers? And how long has it been since some fellow of that character nature came and heard a preacher in the church that you pastor, perhaps you, and came down the aisle and was saved? How long has it been since that happened? If things like that really set a community on its here, didn't they? And usually there would be some real fruit of that come. A lot of other people. Why is that? Do we seldom see that anymore? Got any? Is it our fault, or is it just a cultural circumstance that, you know, we tell people if we don't get them by the time they're what? If we don't win them by the time they're 10, 12 year old, we're never going to get them, and that kind of an attitude we have? Well, I mean, really, we tell people, we announce from the pulpit, look, if you're not saved now by the time you're 12, you're probably never going to be saved. I've heard preachers say that in revival meetings when they're preached. Pardon? I wonder if our witness is very strong in the way we live, that if this guy would see much difference in us and in himself. I wonder, are there any women willing to take a beating from her husband? Anybody want to hold her hand? Since I'm on mine, the only wife here, you guys are terrible. I mean, I feel bad about this. But this was a very typical thing. It is not a typical thing now. It's just the way things have changed. I really don't have any answer, to be quite frank with you.
I think it's a combination of a lot of different things.
But you know, when there's no dynamic conversions, there is a loss of witness in a community. Okay?
Another thing too is how many people are we actually seeing saved in church?
It's getting to be sort of scarce, is it not? It's just an observation that comes to my mind. There have been a few times in my life when I have seen this. Not many, but a few times when I've seen it.